it is about belonging. Some of it is about bringing order to chaos when literally you control nothing around you in a conflict zone. Part of this is about being part of something bigger than yourselves. And that's where I come back to this idea that we're dealing with young people who are coming of age. They want to know what their place is in the world. They want to have an impact. They're trying to figure out who they are, who they belong to. And armed groups know this, and they really do sort of tap into these sort of basic developmental needs.
Siobhan O'Neill spent the last 2 years getting inside the heads of young people who've ended up fighting alongside terrorists or armed groups in their battle-scarred homelands, such as Iraq, Syria, Mali, and Nigeria. Her team of researchers have been looking at why they join, why some eventually leave, and what the UN and other international organizations interested in peace and security can do to stop them from signing up in the first place.
We have a case of a young man. Islamic State had killed his father. His father was an Iraqi policeman. He was deemed an apostate and murdered. And he was a 12-year-old working in a steel factory. And they came to him and said, would you cook for our fighters? And it paid more. And he was the sole breadwinner of 6 siblings and his mother. And so he went to work for the organization that killed his father.
I'm Matt Wells. And for this edition of our Lid Is On podcast from UN News, I'll be talking to Dr. O'Neill about her team's research, which apart from UNICEF and UN peacekeeping, was also supported by the governments of Luxembourg and Switzerland, and finding out what needs to change to stop another generation from being lost to a growing and complex web of armed groups that have become an existential threat to countries such as Mali, Iraq, the Central African Republic, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Ms. O'Neill's first experience with analysing terrorism came in the wake of the 2001 attacks here in Manhattan, when she worked for the newly formed Homeland Security Department in New York and New Jersey. She also worked as a congressional researcher in Washington, D.C., developing her expertise in the security and intelligence fields. There's real danger in seeing religious come ideological radicalization on the battlefield or online as the main recruiting sergeant for angry youth, she argues, who likely have more in common with gang members in urban L.A. than the fundamentalist madrasas of Pakistan's tribal areas.
These sort of what we're calling one-size-fits-none interventions where we think we're just going to say, look, this ideology is wrong, or here are all the problems with it, or you shouldn't do this. We're worried that that could really backfire because on the prevention side, we're not sure that that's as much of a factor for many children as it is largely assumed from the outside.
I sat down with Siobhan in our main podcast studio here at UN headquarters and asked her to explain how the whole thing got underway.
We are very much reacting to some of the assumptions amongst policymakers and some of the assumptions you hear in the media that the groups that are fighting today are somehow fundamentally different and therefore require fundamentally different policy and programmatic responses. So that's inspired our research, but we've taken a very broad approach. So we're looking at 3 contemporary case studies, Syria and Iraq, Mali and Nigeria, but looking across all groups, so not just those groups that get deemed terrorist or violent extremist, but to understand the dynamics of child recruitment and use across the board in conflicts. In some cases, we have survey work. In some cases, we have in-depth interviews with children who've left these groups and are in hiding. So we've tried to use focus groups here and there. We've pulled from all different approaches to really try to get the strongest picture of what's happening, both, you know, the how and why children enter, what their experience is like in those groups, and how and why they exit.
You say in the report that the international community has got slightly outdated and unrealistic views on child violent extremism. Can you just explain in an umbrella way what you mean by that?
We have gotten to a point where, in trying to understand this phenomenon that I think seems so foreign to many of us, this extreme violence that we're seeing by really young people, we tend to use these sort of bracket terms, which are under-conceptualized or are deeply problematic and maybe not empirically supported. So the concept of radicalization, there are a lot of issues with it. But I think it's a shortcut for people who are trying to explain something that they have a hard time sort of understanding. We tried to dig a little bit deeper and really figure out, you know, where is the evidence? What concepts are we actually talking about? And parse these things out so that you can actually create, I think, better policy and programmatic solutions to them by really diagnosing the problem. I think the expectations are, particularly when we're talking about groups that are either labeled as terrorist or violent extremist, when we talk about people exiting, there is not a lot of accommodation for what actually happened. So the expectation is this is a cold turkey event. You leave, that's it. That is what our tolerance level is. But the truth is, the way that kids and young people are associated with these groups, that's not necessarily how they're going to leave. When they live amongst them, the idea that they would have this complete separation is really quite unrealistic. And I also think there's a lot we could learn from other fields here, so particularly the work in criminology and gang dissidence. And so they really parse these things out. So there's disengagement, both physically and mentally from a group, the identity, the association with members. But there's also dissidence, which is stopping criminal offending.
How similar are the links between something like a terrorist group like ISIL or Daesh, Boko Haram, and a violent gang?
No, I think it's a really good question. I think we dismiss these things out of hand, the similarities often, because we say gangs aren't, you know, politically motivated. But if you look especially on the exit question, a lot of the dynamics that happen within gangs and other types of violent groups are very similar to what happened in armed groups. So you have, to some degree, a level of indoctrination, to some degree, some sort of rites of passage to become a full member, sometimes including, engaging particularly in violence to seal that relationship. You have the social bonds between membership. You have the status and identity issues that come with being part of this group. Those are all, broadly similar. So I think there is a lot we can learn here. And it's unfortunate when we sort of dismiss that body of work because it is so rich in the Western world. There's about 100 years on this subject of empirical knowledge that we could pull from. And we really think on the dissidence and disengagement piece that that's quite helpful to draw from that knowledge.
But so then the whole idea of children being psychologically programmed through an extreme form of religion, and that therefore all we need to do is to deprogram, that's just way too simplistic?
I think it is simplistic. Well, there's sort of three parts for this. One is the assumption that often comes with the discussions on ideology and quote-unquote radicalization, that this is a linear process and it's a precursor process to engaging with these groups. There are so many examples of people who get involved with these groups and have nothing like this in their background and do not appear motivated at all by ideology, do not appear to have gone through some, radical shift in beliefs, maybe are associating with a group for really pragmatic reasons. But within a group, you do have an indoctrination period often. And so particularly with some of the groups that are most vexing for us today, whether it's Islamic State or Boko Haram. And then you could see a potential shift. But I think the simplistic idea that it's just ideology, it's not just ideology. It might also be social norms. It might be what's reinforced and rewarded within a group. It might be what affords you status within a group. So I think we just have to be a bit more nuanced in how we think about it. The other thing that I think is really important is some of our work in this area is based on interviews with people as they've left the group or been imprisoned after being associated with a group like this, how they justify their engagement with a group and or with violence can often take a more sort of ideological bent. But again, this
can it be a kind of post-justification?
Exactly. It's a post-facto justification for something that humans are really aversive to, which is violence. And so they have to find a way to live with what they've done. But I think the assumption often from the outside is that's what motivated them to do it. And that's where we're trying to say, wait a minute, let's slow down and really try to understand the nuance of these factors that drive people in, but then also what may happen on the back end after being involved.
I mean, just looking at the case of Mali, I mean, you say that in the report that it's often more to do with intercommunal conflict over resources and cattle. Climate change plays a factor, this sense of being at war against a corrupt state. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these are very much broader issues than simply looking at the ideological motivations. And in many cases, as I think is the case with Mali, these problems and these conflicts are decades old, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Mali's a wonderful case study for this issue of, the narrative that gets applied from the outside, this sort of very simplistic narrative about radicalization or ideology being the crux of a conflict. And then when you dig deeper, as our research team did in Mali, what you find are these very long-standing issues, some of which have been exacerbated by the activities of armed groups, some of which are labeled as terrorist, violent extremist, operating in northern and central Mali. But many of the issues as to why local communities are engaged in the conflict, why individuals, why they align themselves with various groups, that's largely driven by intergroup competition over resources, longstanding feuds. The lack of dispute resolution comes up a lot in Mali. So there's a lot of other issues at play. And if we lose sight of them, we're going to have a hard time designing thoughtful interventions and programmatic responses.
So we've got to stop thinking of groups like ISIL and Daesh and Boko Haram as being somehow exceptionally threatening, exceptionally different.
We always should go into the assessment, the situational awareness we do in conflicts, with an open mind. And there are aspects of these groups that are different or exaggerated or on a much greater scale than what we've seen with other groups. And at the same time, when we treat them as exceptional, when we cordon them off as a subgroup that should be treated differently, I think we lose sight on some of the dynamics that are actually way more important. So you get this focus with Islamic State and with Boko Haram on ideology, but you may lose sight on the fact that this is some of these organizations are deeply fractionalized, or they have different competing factions with different interests, or that they had instrumentally used religion as a way of coming into communities and creating really what were tactical relationships to build momentum for their movement. But we lose sight of all of that when we apply this very sort of simplistic lens about, you know, these are ideological, extreme ideological violent extremist groups. And that's the only way we think about them.
So how then does a child become a living bomb? I mean, obviously, the most extreme threat that they pose, and certainly in the case of Boko Haram in the last few years, has been this notion that that child recruits end up blowing themselves up. And I think the assumption's always been, well, that must be driven, surely, from an ideological place, you know, that they're seeking this glorious afterlife in the name of the twisted version of religion that they've been brainwashed into.
These are always sad cases, but it's particularly sad in the Nigerian case, because many of the children, we think, actually had no idea what they were actually doing. So that is one explanation. There are people who do have an idea of what they're doing, but it is fascinating when you look across particular case studies of children and adults who've made some of these decisions, and you still find examples where people...
It's mundane.
It can be. And so we've heard anecdotes of people who were offered, now they were often abducted, but they were offered better conditions during their time within the group if they would eventually accept this mission. And so you think to yourself, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense that you would get, you know, better food and treatment. It's hard to imagine what life must be like.
So in a horribly sort of twisted way, it's sacrificing your life for the greater good of the group.
Or at least maybe have your basic needs filled in the short time that you might be allowed there. And again, these are anecdotes. Children associated with armed groups is an invisible population that is very hard to access. And when you do access them, there are a lot of sensitivities and they may not be forthright with you. Just imagine this is like the subset of the subset in trying to really understand what's going on there.
So despite your 2 years of work, these are just some examples.
There are some things that we can say across conflicts. Conflicts are very different. There's huge variation within conflicts. Even from town to town, you see variations of what factors really play a significant role. Even for each child, one of the things we say in this work is there is no sort of magic cocktail for understanding why children become associated. It's a very individualized journey, which can be quite challenging when we try to think about how you scale up programming and on the prevention side. But I think also it's helpful for us to think about this really very much from a child-centered focus about what their particular needs, what their particular risks are. But the other thing to mention is that, you know, across conflicts, we are dealing with young people who are in a stage of development in their life where there are some similarities. And so that's one of the reasons that we think certain armed groups have been particularly popular with young people is because they tap into things. And one of them, you know, we talk about...
Yeah, you talk about pro-social motivations. Just explain that phrase.
Well, I think, you know, in some of the discourse, especially in the media, when we hear about people being involved in these groups that are so beyond the norms of society that we just sort of assume you have to be inspired by, you know, bloodlust or revenge or something very negative. But for young people, some of them in certain contexts could see these groups as actually providing very positive rewards. Some of it is about belonging. Some of it is about bringing order to chaos when literally you control nothing around you in a conflict zone. Part of this is about potentially status. Part of this is about being part of something bigger than yourselves. And that's where I come back to this idea that we're dealing with young people who are coming of age. They want to know what their place is in the world. They want to have an impact. They're trying to figure out who they are, who they belong to. And armed groups know this, and they really do sort of tap into these sort of basic developmental needs.
So what do UN programs aimed at trying to get children out of these situations, trying to reintegrate them, what do they and other NGO programs need to do differently based on the research you've done? That's the key question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have an easy pull-off-the-shelf solution to offer, and I know that's very frustrating for practitioners. But I do think there are some sort of negative lessons learned that we can pull from this research. I do think there are some principles that overall could have a very positive effect. These are not necessarily new to practitioners, but I think our research refocuses the necessity of dealing with them. And some of these are things that get lost in the wayside when budgets are tight or when you're programming in very difficult circumstances. But, you know, one of the greatest takeaways, I think, is engaging the people themselves. So not just seeing them as beneficiaries, but seeing them as partners. And for young people who
empowering them in a way,
absolutely
respecting them, even though obviously in many cases they've done terrible things.
Yeah, I mean, these are kids and young people who want to be part of something bigger, who want to contribute to their societies. It may seem strange to us that Islamic State or Boko Haram or one of these groups was the medium through which they thought they could do this, or maybe the only medium that they had available to them. But why not take a reintegration process and provide them with that same opportunity to empower them? There's a lot of research in psychology that suggests that when people are part of the solution, they're more likely to be engaged and the outcomes are much better. So we should be engaging children around that, particularly on the ideological front. These sort of what we're calling one-size-fits-none interventions where we think we're just going to say, look, this ideology is wrong, or here are all the problems with it, or you shouldn't do this. We're worried that that could really backfire, again, because on the prevention side, we're not sure that that's as much of a factor for many children as it is largely assumed from the outside.
So we've got to encourage, not use any kind of coercion or sort of moral arguments about changing their ways and becoming better people.
Yeah, I also just think if that's not a child's particular risk factor, if that's not what is leading them down a path closer to one of these armed groups, if it's the fact that you know, literally their father is gone and they have become the sole breadwinner and they need to put food on the table for a family. If it's because, you know, they've got an uncle in one of these groups who's pressuring them to join, like, it must ring really hollow for someone then to get up and sort of talk to you about beliefs if that's not your issue at all.
So some of these programs just are barking up the wrong tree, to use a cliche.
Not only barking up the wrong tree, so maybe just being ineffective, but also potentially having negative consequences. So if they result in stigma to the population that you are applying them to, and now that stigma makes someone even more likely to be associated with an armed group, that's having that's really setting us back a step.
There is a great danger, of course, in the bigger picture that, you know, as long as that armed group is out there next door, continues to thrive, then there'll be that temptation that if reintegrating just doesn't work, then they're just going to go straight back into the arms of that armed group.
I think that's such an important point because, especially in our Syria and Iraq case study, we see examples where people come out with seemingly the intention of staying out, and they are drawn back in because of forces really beyond their control. If you're reintegrated back into a situation where there is no employment but the armed group, where everyone assumes you're associated. So if you don't associate with someone, you're unprotected. That is not a situation where it is really realistic that somebody can remain neutral, even if they want to. But we also have a couple anecdotal situations of young people who had left Syria. They were in Turkey, but they were treated so badly that they kept thinking that life in the armed group was actually better than it was in civilian employment, because they were so discriminated against and they were so unhappy. And so that's something, I think, where we can make a change potentially and think about how these kids leave, you know, particularly because they have gotten some sort of, they may have derived some sort of positive impact from these groups, whether it was status, whether it was a sense of identity, a sense of camaraderie with other people. And if they lose all of it, you know, how is that going to affect if they stay out or not? The other thing I'll just mention briefly is it's not just getting pulled back into the group you left, which is quite possible and happens a lot, but there's also this issue of side switching. And so we see people, and this is again comes back to the ideology question, you see people who have been in Islamic State and they get pulled out and they go into the group that's fighting Islamic State. And the next thing you know, go back into
another group. It's the life they
know. It's not only the life they know, but they're doing this for completely, you know, reasons completely divorced of ideology or even goals. Yeah. Or it's just basic needs that they need covered, or it's protection, or it's family connections. I mean, we have a case of a young man. Islamic State had killed his father. His father was an Iraqi policeman. He was deemed an apostate and murdered. And he was a 12-year-old working in a steel factory. And they came to him and said, would you cook for our fighters? And it paid more. And he was the sole breadwinner of six siblings and his mother. And so he went to work for the organization that killed his father. And then his uncle recruited him to actually work and spy on behalf of a Shia militia that was fighting against ISIS. So you have these crazy situations where people are sort of ping-ponging between groups just to survive and get by.
And while that instability and mayhem continues, then there's really very little chance of, in any organized or meaningful way, turning these people back into productive, conventional citizens, really.
Well, I think that's a really good point. There is the question about whether we have unrealistic expectations for interventions and programs in these contexts. That doesn't mean we don't respond, but it does mean if you have children in an active conflict, do we need to temper our expectations a bit about what it means to reintegrate into civilian life? And maybe do we need to alter our programs a bit around that? Because you can just imagine if you're still in the level of instability that we're talking about, it's just extremely difficult for a child to remain unaffiliated. If you think about the Mali context, if your entire, you know, if you're a young person and your entire community has aligned with an outside armed group for protection, that means everyone in the community is mobilized. As a 14-year-old, are you able to stand up to your parents, your siblings, and the community at large and say, no, I opt out?
It's going to be extremely difficult and costly to come up with effective programs that will actually work.
Yes and no. I mean, there is a lot that the child protection and the development community is already doing, which could potentially have a huge effect. Now, can we demonstrate that effect, that it actually, you know, prevents children from going down these roads? That's somewhat hard to do. But these are great programs that we should be doing anyway. You know, should we help bolster education systems in places that need them? Absolutely. Does it keep kids off the streets and away from armed groups that are just lurking in the streets? Yes, absolutely. Does it potentially expand their minds and get them to consider alternate viewpoints? Absolutely. Does it potentially give them a leg up to be more successful in civilian life and have job and career opportunities? Absolutely. So those are all positive things, and they potentially could have an impact, and we should be doing them anyway.
There is a lot of concern around the world that social media is like a kind of gateway drug for violent extremists, for young violent extremists in particular. You know, you hear the phrase, he was radicalized online, a lot in the media. I mean, is that also a somewhat simplistic way to approach this obviously key issue?
Our research tried to focus a little bit on this, and we do see, particularly in the Syria and Iraq case studies, you get a difference within a conflict zone and in the areas adjacent or further afield. And so social media plays a role for Syrian and Iraqi kids who become entangled with Islamic State. It's not this driving factor. Now, when you look at kids who come from further afield, social media and media more broadly do seem, in some cases, to play a bigger role. And that makes sense. It's sort of obvious. You have a situation where people who are thousands of miles away, the way they interact with a conflict, the way they understand the conflict, the way they interact with its perpetrators, its victims, that all happens.
They aren't seeing and living the consequences of that awful violence.
Yeah, I mean, the only way they can interact is that way. Now, I think there are some real questions, and this is something that the academic community continues to work on, how those virtual relationships mirror, bolster, or are different from real interpersonal relationships. And I think that's something we're still trying to understand. I do think, as you say, there's a bit of caution here against some of these sort of overly simplistic assumptions about, again, this sort of precursor process called radicalization that happens online. And you may have people who found out about these things online, but they may be driven by very different things. I mean,
again, alienation, resentment, anger.
But not only just negative things. I think one of the things that's very underplayed in sort of the Western media particularly is the draw, the very positive messaging. You know, we see the horrible beheading propaganda videos, and that's our view of ISIS often. But really, there's this whole other world of strategic communications that Islamic State engages in that are about this utopian society that they've created and the role that you can play in building a better world.
The caliphate.
Yeah.
In that case.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, contributing, responding to a conflict that young people are seeing and they're, you know, horrified by, and responding in a positive way. Like, you can come not just be a fighter per se, but you can come be a nurse, or you could come, you know, help build this community. You can come to a place where you're not going to be discriminated against. And that can be very powerful for young people who maybe are facing stigma in their local communities. The other thing that we don't talk a lot about that's super interesting is that this appeal of romance that Islamic State has broadcast to young people.
Find your dream fighter husband.
Yeah, and to men and women likewise. And it's not just marriage, but it's this sort of romantic ideal of the perfect man or the pious woman.
So finally, do you think that the more we know, the better we're going to get at dealing with this issue and at trying to neutralize the appalling impacts of violence among young people who associate themselves with armed groups and terrorist organizations?
I think as a researcher, I have to say yes, in the sense that I think empirically driven interventions are always going to be more accurate. That is not to say that this is easy.
They've got to be turned into effective solutions to actually change the reality on the ground, haven't they?
Yeah, and part of this might be us learning more and more about what not to do. We have a lot of programs that are traditional development programs, but they've been rebranded as, you know, preventing violent extremism. And so you have to think about, well, what's the impact of that on the community that now is a beneficiary? And does that have any added benefit, or could we learn from that? And is there a way to maybe have the same impact that you think you might be having, but also do it in a way that you don't cause stigma and alienation? So I think always the more we study, the more we know, the more we're willing to do this kind of nuanced situational analysis, we will prepare better programmatic and policy interventions. But it's not to say that it's easy, unfortunately.
It's going to be a long road ahead.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Siobhan O'Neill, project leader for UN University's two-year study, Cradled in Conflict, on how and why children become involved with terror and other armed groups in today's theatres of war. You've been listening to The Lid Is On, a podcast series from UN News. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks as always for tuning in.